All right, this is Film Study with Tim McCusick for week two. The Ravens just defeated the Browns 24-10, where we got to see another great defensive performance. And we're going to break all that down today with the man whose name's in the title, Ken McCusick. Ken, how are you doing today?
Life's good, Josh. How about you?
I'm doing okay. I mean, the Orioles aren't done, but the Ravens are showing that, all right, maybe there's something exciting this year.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just get right into it. The defense, we questioned a lot after week one if this defense was for real or if the Bengals were just bad. So now week two, I've got the same question for you. Is this defense for real or are the Browns just as bad as the Bengals?
Yeah, I guess it's possible we still don't know. I mean, the Browns, I think most people would agree, are a pretty bad team. Even what I'm seeing now on most wagering lines is people still think the Browns are less likely to win the division than the Bengals are, even though I think they're probably a lot better than we thought they were. But yeah, it's been a fairly weak schedule so far. I think Jacksonville is another opponent that's only a step up, not a step up to the playoff teams the Ravens would hope to compete with in January.
So week four is when we actually get to see what this team's made of.
Yeah, it'll be tough coming back from London, playing the Steelers even at home. I expect that to be a real challenge, and then immediately going on the road and playing Oakland, a tough double, that's for sure.
Right, right. Well, it's not bad if you're going to have a tough double to have a soft start for your season.
Yeah, give us as many soft games as possible as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
But yeah.
All right, so 5 turnovers again, 10 turnovers in 2 games. Are they leading the NFL in turnovers right now?
Oh, by a wide margin, right? Yeah. They lead in plus-minus with +7. They lead in turnovers with 10. They lead in interceptions with 8. In fact, no other team has more than 3 interceptions currently other than the Ravens. So they're off to a fantastic start. And obviously that begs one of the questions is, can they sustain this level? Is it reasonable to expect that they would continue to have these kind of levels of turnovers? And the answer to that is, of course not. They will get less turnovers as the season goes on. But what they've done so far is extremely impressive, even given the favorable circumstances they've been playing under so far. So just to talk a little bit about this, what kind of circumstances favor turnovers? Well, several things do, but the biggest one is that you have the lead, and you have the lead late. But the Ravens, in fact, have never trailed this season and have led for almost the entire 120 minutes that they've played. So they've certainly been playing with a big advantage in terms of turnover creation. One of the things I sometimes hear an announcer will say, a color guy, and I just think like it's the smartest thing anybody's ever said. He'll say that the team that wins the turnover battle will probably win the game. And it really should be reversed to say that from causality perspective, that it's the team that wins the game that will typically win the turnover battle, because the trailing team has to do things, has to take more chances in order to advance the ball, and in so doing, they generate more turnovers.
Right, it's the same run argument, that running the ball means you win, and it's the other
way
around.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I hope they can continue it. I mean, 5 turnovers sure makes it an exciting defense to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. You're waiting for these predators to scoop up another one or pick another one out of the air, and they've done a great job with tipped balls. You know, in a lot of ways, what they've done so far has been really special. And last year, they led the league in 2 very important interception statistics. They led in interceptions purely. They were one of 3 teams with 18. They led in per pass attempted. So they had 18 of the 578 passes against them, 3.1% were intercepted. And a very important statistic, they led in the percentages of the of passes defensed that were intercepted. So you get your hand on an opposing football that doesn't end up as a reception, it's called a pass defensed. And of those, they had 70 last season in 16 games, a little more than 4 per game. 18 of those ended up being interceptions, so 25.7%.
So that's a little tip ball.
A tip ball. A tip ball up the line of scrimmage, be a typical one, but it can also happen in the secondary where the cornerback defends the wide receiver from getting the ball and he tips it and knocks it free.
Okay.
So last year they led the NFL, as I mentioned, with 25.7%. If you turn that over and you make it the number of passes defensed per interception, it's 3.89. This year, they've had 17 PDs, which leads the NFL by five, and they've had eight interceptions. They've had only 2.13 passes defensed per interception, so the lower the better in that case, and that's just an extraordinary ratio so far. But it's been a dual effort. They've really converted their opportunities, but they've also had a lot more opportunities as they move from 20th in the league in PDs last year to first this year so far. So the Ravens have a famous tennis ball drill they do during camp. The players absolutely love it. There's a few play drills that they absolutely love, but they like this one. Sometimes Suggs even gets in the act, and it certainly seems to have paid off for this team.
The tennis ball drill, how does that work?
Well, they shoot. At first, they were low-tech, and they just had a guy with a racket coming out and swatting balls to them. Then they got a tennis ball gun to shoot the balls downfield. But by tracking a smaller ball that's shot not to a set point that they can determine, supposedly that gives them a better chance to track the ball and then also catch a ball, which is harder to catch than a football for them.
All right, so this is kind of like Happy Gilmore going out to the batting cage to practice his hockey.
Yeah, I remember that movie vaguely in terms of he putts like it's a slap shot.
Oh, he'd go out to the batting cage and take the balls and let him hit him in the chest to show how strong he is and that he can handle it.
Right.
So it's a similar using other sports tools to improve your football game. And it makes sense. A tennis ball is much smaller than a football. So, yeah, if you can knock down a tennis ball, you're going to get at least a finger on that football.
Yeah. And the goal is to catch it, of course, and that's you have to have soft hands. And it's a very fun drill to watch, and it's they give each other a lot of grief over. It's a fun drill to be around.
Yeah, it sounds fun. It sounds like exciting and just a different twist than the same practice all the time. So, all right, are they gonna? So obviously, they're not going to continue with five a game.
Right?
Do you think we've seen good things for that? They're going to build on that. They're going to be able to get turnovers even from the good teams.
Yeah, I do. I think they have most of the components necessary to get a lot of turnovers. And the components I'll give you is you have a pretty good overall team. So having a good defensive team and an okay offensive team, or maybe slightly below average, is going to mean they're playing ahead more than they're playing from behind. That should help them. If I look at other things, they have a good high pressure pass rush and defensive line, which compresses the pocket. Should create more tip balls. Those tip balls should turn into more opportunities in level two and level three for interceptions. They have a high quality secondary. Most of them have good ball skills. The one guy I really had talked about not having good ball skills before the year began, Brandon Carr, already has two picks. So what do I know? So it's a good secondary for getting picks.
All right. I mean, that's one wonderful to hear, because that is, if you ask Baltimore fans what makes a good defense, they will all point to Ed Reed and the impact that Ed Reed would make on the ball. And we don't have Ed Reed. But if we got five guys out in the field that can come together as one Ed Reed, that'll be fun to watch this season. So this defense, it looks good in two games. What's the best way for us to grade them? Or do they look good because of the turnovers? Is it the yardage? Is it the fact that it took three quarters of the game for the Browns to get into the red zone? How do we judge them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the things that I really like is that they're winning all of the battles up front, the one-on-one battles up front. So they're front five defenders, and they have a front five on a lot of plays. Sometimes it's a four-man front when they go to the nickel or the dime. But when they have the five-man front in there, they're winning most of those one-on-one battles. Having Brandon Williams, having Pierce, Urban, and whether it's Suggs and whoever else we have on the other side, has been a lot of one-on-one matchup wins, and he's no substitute for that. If you can get into the backfield and make the quarterback start to think about where his feet are, you've won half the battle in terms of defending the pass. That's the single biggest factor of what I've got. The press coverage has helped them give them more time to get pressure on the quarterback. And frankly, they're getting a lot of unforced errors presently from quarterbacks who kind of feel the pass rush before it gets there as well. So a combination of things that I think has really, really done well. And I think that if I had to pull one other thing, it's the fact that it's been a very simple scheme so far, a very vanilla scheme. And we could go a little bit deeper into that if you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, let's get into that vanilla. We talked last week about how against the Bengals, they were no surprises. I think they rushed like twice in the game. Right. Did they improve? They rushed more this week, right? Or am I just seeing everything and thinking it's a rush when it's not really?
Well, it was a very vanilla rush game. So they had 45 total times the Browns dropped back, which was more than the Bengals did. I think the Bengals might have 36. But in the 45 times the Browns dropped back, they rushed 4 39 times. They rushed 3 once, and they rushed 5 times. And so they did not rush numbers at all.
Okay.
And the other thing is the blitz that we talked about last time. And the blitz is really how many deceptive blitzes did they have or were trying to do. So how many people that you didn't expect to come came, or did they run twists and stunts, or did they have people drop from the line of scrimmage? They had 3 deceptive blitzes against the Bengals. They only had 2 against the Browns. They had 6 people blitz in this game, 6 individuals. Not every one of those ends up being a deceptive blitz, but it's still not much in the way of tricks from the Ravens playbook has been shown at all. So that's very positive. I mean, I can't be much more positive than this. And they went through a little bit of difficulty in this game with the injury to Brandon Williams and having to adapt to that. And Pease was making use throughout the game, in fact, of 3 outside linebackers on a lot of the pass rush snaps. So he moved Matt Judon primarily to the inside to rush from there, and I've kind of been expecting that because the Ravens have a lot of talented pass rushers at outside linebacker, and they all want to be on the field on third down to get sacks.
Right. Bowser did that some too as well, right?
That's right. Bowser was on the inside at least once or twice, and Bowser got his first sack in the game, which I guess we'll get to a little later.
All right. Well, let's get to it. Let's start with the defensive line, where we really get to break down and evaluate how each player did. So where do you want to start? Do you want to start with Michael Pierce?
Sure, we can do that. I'll start by saying that the Ravens only had 5 of their 8 defensive linemen active again. So, again, same guys, Henry, Calfusi, and Wormley, again, sat. The Ravens have a lot of talent that they have in those 7 spots that they obviously don't want to let go of. They probably would like to figure out if they're going to make a trade by week 4 when the trade deadline is. And then it's possible somebody like Wormley might get injured suspiciously during practice and go to IR for the year. But as of right now, they have a lot of talent sitting there not doing anything on the inactive list.
Can any of them switch to offensive line?
And, you know, you asked that before. There is a team that's doing some of that is Seattle has switched a few of those people. And the Ravens have Patrick Ricard, and they've used him, of course, in short yardage situations, so that's useful. They're not really using him on the defensive line. He didn't play a single defensive snap on Sunday, although he played on offense. So there is some opportunity to take advantage of that. And obviously, the Ravens are very shorthanded on offense, as we get to tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get to that tomorrow. But, yeah, the offense could use some bodies.
Yeah.
So, all right, Michael Pierce. He had 40
Michael
snaps.
Pierce. Yeah, 40 snaps, as you saw, so solid game. He had 1 tackle assist. He otherwise had pressures on a streak of 3 out of 4 plays that was very impressive. He flushed the guy once that led to a cleanup sack by Anwaso, so I thought we'd make an effort to say his name properly this time, and hopefully we're doing it and not butchering it more.
You can, but I'll never say it right. Not
I
by
put
choice.
A little phonetic spelling in here, as it will. All right. Anyway, Pierce, just scary quickness for a big man, and very lucky to have him on this contract for 4 years, or for 3 years, actually. And he will produce significantly, and I think he's already going to be a player the Ravens want to get for a second contract. So he's done very well.
All right. That's exciting. No, I mean, that's just exciting. It leads to the question of Brandon Williams. And he made an impact in the game yesterday before he went out. Is he going to be, I guess you can talk about how he did yesterday, but the real question with Brandon Williams is what's the future?
Right. So we have an undisclosed foot injury at present. Now, whenever I hear that, I'm always afraid it might be a Liz Frank injury, and we haven't heard that. Yanda had an ankle injury. It turned out to be a much more serious fractured ankle situation. He's out for the year. Brandon Williams, we don't know yet. A Liz Frank injury, if it is that, is a very long-term injury. It can last more than a year to completely rehab for it, so it wouldn't necessarily be right next year. Elvis Dumervil went through the same thing. He certainly was not right the next season. So there is would be great fear if that's what it ended up with. And he's great talent. He had a pressure in 9 snaps. He's had 7 pressures already this year as I score them. He had 3 tackles on 10 run snaps. So he was really dominating the game by himself before he left, and it'd be a shame if they ended up losing him. The Ravens do have some very significant depth at his positions, the 1 and 3 tech spots. So they have Willie Henry available. They could go to Wormley and bring him in playing that position. They have Carl Davis, who they've hardly used for any snaps so far. So there's a good amount of depth there. That's not the biggest concern from that perspective. But Brandon Williams is a star, and we prefer to have him there taking as many snaps as possible.
All right. All right. You want to just what's the best way to do this? Just continue through with Brent Urban and just keep going through the line?
Sure, can talk about Brent Urban next. And he got the other lion's share of snaps. He got 50 snaps in this game, which meant for the second straight game, he led the team in defensive line and playing times. He got a nice pass rush against Zeitler. Now, Zeitler is a former Pro Bowler for the Bengals and a good player that the Browns picked up on a very big contract. But honestly, Brent Urban played very well against him, and I thought he was very effective getting into the backfield. Had one nice play on a run. He got the pressure, which led to Suggs' cleanup strip sack. So Suggs had been blocked behind the pocket. Urban came up, hand up in the face of the quarterback, forced him to move to the right, and Suggs caught up with him and dislodged the football. So you don't often get the other guy who sets up that play, but Urban has done a lot of that. Certainly playing very well right now. And while these three guys are so outstanding, it's really hard to find any time for any other defensive lineman to play. And so the only other guy who saw time during this game was Carl Davis. He had 10 snaps in this game, and I often have to caution people. The snap totals I have won't be the equivalent of what you'll see necessarily on other sites, because I exclude accepted penalties, as well as some other things, kneels and spikes and whatnot, but accepted penalties are the main one. Carl Davis played 10 snaps. They have something called the Oklahoma drill they do at camp. The Bengals had this. It was very big on their Hard Knocks series. But you go one-on-one with one other lineman, and then you also try and tackle, work off your block to make a tackle on a running back. And he had 2 of those plays where he's engaged with a lineman but also used one arm to kind of hold off the lineman, one arm to take down a running back, both times Crowell for gains of 2 yards. So that was impressive. He did was not able to get off the field once when he should have as the 12th man. That cost the Ravens a free play. It almost cost them a big play. Moore will be relied. He'll be relied on more as Williams is absent, and hopefully he'll play better.
All right. You say there's no room for other people to play. That's a good thing. That's a good problem to have.
Oh, sure. Sure, yeah, the Ravens' depth is wonderful. And, they're at a point where they're so – you ask, can anybody play the offensive line? Maybe the correct proper question is, could they trade one of these guys and get an offensive lineman? Because that's their great need. And it would be better if the rest of the league needed defensive linemen at this juncture. But it doesn't really seem to be the case. The Ravens, I would think, would have a trade already worked out if that was the case.
Right, and that's where you kind of question, well – one of these guys who isn't able to get on the field, you would think he would be a little motivated to, hey, let me try out the other side of the ball.
Yeah, I mean, if it's probably a longer term project is part of the deal. If you really want to convert someone to an offensive line, it may be a year long process of taking him through camp and learning some different things. It could happen in an emergency, Josh, and it has before, where you have to have a defensive lineman move over to play offensive line to close out a game. So it could happen in that
case. Sure,
I mean,
yes, I'm making it sound a whole lot simpler than it is. I'm just saying, we've got a practice squad full of guys that could be on another defensive squad, maybe. They'll try whatever it takes to make it to the big time.
Oh, if you look at what Patrick Ricard did, he's apparently very excited to take offensive snaps, and he's only had 1 defensive snap so far, so it is a model.
Yeah, that's a good example. All right, linebackers. We are still healthy in linebackers, right?
Largely healthy. Za'Darius Smith missed this game. We've been told it's not long-term. We've been told maybe he's coming back in terms of London. I don't really believe it. We'll see Za'Darius whenever we do. They had 4 healthy outside linebackers for this game. They all played. So Tim Williams made his NFL debut in this game along with Suggs, Judon, and Bowser. It's a very talented group, and they were exciting to watch, even without Zadarius, who has just been a monster in his very limited duty this year and in the preseason. So excited about the group as a whole. I guess we'll start with Terrell Suggs, who had 44 snaps in this game. He is just piling up numbers. He already had his third sack and second forced fumble in this game. He had two other quarterback hits and two other pressures in this game as well. One of the things I found interesting, Joe Thomas was working on a streak, and the fourth snap of the game was set to be his 10,000th consecutive snap. And Joe Thomas, there was a false start on the first play of the game, and I wasn't sure if that was going to get counted under the snap counts that they had for Thomas, but apparently they didn't, because the fourth snap of the game would have been number 10,000 in a row, and Suggs got a quarterback hit, and I was so excited about that, because he beat Joe Thomas for the QH and bowled him and then shed him to take down Kaiser, and I thought that would have been a great way to go. But it was number 99-99, and then they ran for 9 yards with Thomas making a good block on the next play, so... life goes on, but a great accomplishment for Thomas. He's the Iron Man of football.
It's impressive to play 10 years and not miss a snap. Is crazy.
And that's just about what it is, about 1,000 snaps a year, right, to get to 10,000.
But, yeah, I was amazed watching the game that, again, just like week one, Suggs was all over the place. And it was like the young Suggs that I thought, all right, well, it's week one, he's fresh. Here he is week two, and he looked just as good.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely benefiting from the people around. There's a lot of things that are nice. Press coverage on the outside is giving him a little more time to get to the quarterback. You know, I mentioned the hand in the face from Urban, but the pocket compression in the middle is making it much easier for Suggs to track down that quarterback and take him down. So it's a very good opportunity in the twilight of his career to rack up hopefully a nice statistical year in addition to solidify his first ballot Hall of Fame standing in Canton. We're sure he'll go, but it's just a question of whether he'll go on his first ballot or not. And, yeah, it's a great situation for him.
Right. All right, let's move on with Matthew Judon.
So Judon led the outside linebackers in snaps, and I mentioned some of this earlier, but he had 54 snaps in the game. A lot of it was on the outside at the Sam linebacker position, where he's done fine, and he does drop to coverage there occasionally, but he also had these 20 snaps on the inside in this game. In this three outside linebacker package where they moved him to the inside. So that's very much the Pernell McPhee role of old. Judon is a big, lean guy and powerful but lean, and certainly is somebody who, if he could create some double teams, get some shoulders turned on the inside, it could be very exciting. Now, you really have to take advantage of that by bringing a blitz behind him. So a Mosley or a Peanut or, because it's passing down, it's probably a Levine coming on a delayed blitz. It makes a lot of sense if Judon is going to be taking that first step into a gap and creating openings. So lots of chances there to do that. Judon himself, he had a brutal quarterback hit that took down Hoden on Bowser's interception. I was looking at the play and I thought he was going to get flagged for it, but Sterator was looking directly at the play, kind of nodded at him, and no flag was coming out. And then the quarterback amazingly got up and made the tackle on Bowser. I didn't think he was going to get up again. Anyway, impressive day again from Judon, and it's nice to see that versatility to have him move inside.
That's great. All right, the rookie, Tim Williams.
So, okay, Tim Williams, 21 snaps in his NFL debut. The last play of the game, the 4th-and-7 attempt with 32 seconds left to go, he beat Joe Thomas cleanly to the outside. Real pass rush move in terms of the speed to get around a very experienced, high-quality left tackle. He had one other play where he flushed Kaiser from the pocket and chased him down. It was a 3-yard gain, and you could see Williams was hoping it would be his first sack, and then he kind of looked at where the linesman was setting up, and he saw, oh, no, just missed it. But anyway, very good first view against quality opposition that we got out of Tim Williams in 21 snaps.
Now, quality opposition, but they're still the Browns.
Well, it's still the Browns, but their left tackle, Joe Thomas, is their best player.
So because he was lined up with Joe Thomas.
Yeah.
All right. It's time for Bowser.
Bowser. Okay, so your favorite. Now, Bowser's role.
My favorite.
Bowser's role tremendously increased this week, and he basically hit for the cycle in terms of defensive accomplishments in this game. mixed metaphors aside. So what are his three responsibilities as an outside linebacker? One is always going to be get in there in the pass rush when they ask him to. As the Sam, that will always be less than as the rush linebacker, where he's opposite just a tackle. Bowser lines up opposite a tight end, and he may have to cover that tight end on some plays. But he did rush the quarterback near the goal line, took him down for a 4 or 5 yard sack back to within a yard or two of the goal line, and that was his first NFL sack. Good to see that. Later on in the first half, just a few plays later, he intercepted a pass along the right sideline and returned it 27 yards, and that set up the TD that gave the Ravens that nice, more comfortable 2 touchdown leads. He also stuffed a run play effectively. He held the right edge, pinched to the inside, made a tackle on Johnson. I like to see all those things. Edge setting for Bowser is a big way for him to contribute. And that cycle of contributions says to me he's ready for yet more playing time. So we'll see what happens to Judon at this point. He may become more of an inside situational rusher, and Bowser may become the starter. But very impressed with Bowser's play.
All right, so 34 snaps. So you're expecting in London he might be up to like 50?
That would be great. I mean, 50 snaps for him. If maybe their snap numbers reversed, but Judon can be kept more fresh as a pass rusher, I think that might be a nice mix. That was always the case with Pernell McPhee. They kept him very fresh, and even though by far the most dynamic player on the defense, it was very valuable to keep him fresh in 2014 in particular to get the pass rush really cranked up when you needed it.
Okay. All right. Now, the one guy, I guess, who was on the field for every single play of the game, well, defensive play, of course, would be C.J. Mosley.
Yeah, so C.J. Mosley was on the field for every play, he and a couple other people, but he led the Ravens in tackles with 10. He had a sack that got lost to just a completely bogus illegal use of hands penalty against Jimmy Smith. So he had a very, very nice delayed blitz sack. So shame he lost that. He did get caught underneath, meaning he got beat over the top in zone coverage several times on some long plays, and I really want to look at the top view in particular to figure out exactly what the Ravens were doing that play, because it's very hard to tell from the broadcast video. But he got beat by a 20-yard catch by Telfer, and that was near the right sideline. The 49-yard play that their backup tight end had, which was 21 on the throw and 28 more yak by the right sideline, same basic thing. Mosley was the closest. I'm still not 100% convinced it was his responsibility on the play, but it well might have been. And then the other guy that the Browns had in this game, Higgins, had a 28-yard catch by the left sideline. Now, Higgins, Rashard Higgins, he is a practice squad guy who just got promoted. In fact, he just got promoted a day or two before, such that he did not make the game day scorebook. So his number 81 is not even listed for the Browns. Their top three guys are a bunch of veterans. They're Corey Coleman, is actually a second-year player and a first-round draft pick last year. Kenny Britt, and I'm thinking of the third one, Sammy Coates, who used to play for the Steelers. So they're big-time speed and deep threats. And those three guys had 13 balls targeted their way during the game, 2 catches for 11 yards. So not an impressive day for those three. And the outside corners, in particular for the Ravens, did a wonderful job shutting them down. But they did not shut down Rashard Higgins.
Right. What happens with that? Why do you think it ends up being that there's one guy who's just breaking everything open? Is it they didn't game plan for him? That they focused on the big guys and left the practice squad guy alone?
Yep, the two things you exactly said are exactly it. They don't really game plan for him, and they target, but try and take away the big receivers. So they did a good job of taking away Coleman. They did a good job of taking away Britt and taking away Coates, but they really did not plan to deal with Higgins. And Higgins was effective and beat linebackers and safeties for receptions in this game, and that's how he was effective. But that's exactly why it would occur.
All right. Well, let's use that then to talk about the secondary and how they did. We can start with Jimmy Smith, because you were just mentioning him because of that holding play with C.J. Mosley.
Right.
On TV, that did not look like a hold.
No, it really didn't. And it's standard press coverage, and sometimes the official will see something he didn't really see. He went up high to one shoulder to push the guy and gets flagged for, you know, hitting him in the mask. If you look at it, I mean, there was no snap back to the head or anything. There wasn't any indication that should have been an illegal hands penalty. It's just, it was
so that ridiculous. Was a, that was just a human error.
Yeah.
All right. So how did Jimmy Smith do?
So I thought he did very well in the game. There was a throw or two behind him, but he didn't allow any super big receptions in the game, so that was fine. Brandon Carr on the other side was even better, so maybe we can talk about him next, because he was really the Ravens' best defensive player and just consistently used the boundary well time after time, starting with the very first pass they threw at him, which was an offensive pass interference on Britt that negated a completion there. He basically is the one who held Coleman for most of his one catch for 9 yards in 7 targets day. And, you know, this is a number one draft pick for them. This is a guy who has to produce if the Browns are going to have some semblance of an offense. So what they did with him was very, very effective. He was in the neighborhood of Njoku's touchdown. So he was down the sideline a decent direction. Jefferson was also converging. The two of them could not stop the basically laser beam throw that went in there and was completed for the Browns' only touchdown. You know, it was always sad to see the Ravens give up what we consider to be a long touchdown, about 20 yards. You know, it's all of a sudden the scoring streak is over and whatnot. But it was what it was, and the Ravens are going to give up some plays this year.
Right. On TV, sometimes it looks like the Ravens really give the receiver space.
Yeah, especially underneath, I agree with that. So they sometimes play off coverage, which means they're 7, 8, 9 yards off the receiver. And particularly with fast receivers, you can do that. It usually means you're trying to take some kind of a zone concept with that. If they want to give the pass rush an advantage, they come up in press coverage, and then it's like the Jimmy Smith illegal use of hands play. They're immediately trying to disrupt that receiver during the first 5 yards of the route where they're allowed to touch the receiver.
So they're trying to screw up the run from the start.
Yeah, so get it mistimed from the quarterback's perspective, right. So he can't get the throw off.
Right, because it seems like if someone wants to throw a 10-yard pass, we're giving them away left and right sometimes. Playing back, not letting us be beat big.
There's a lot of theory that you can't defend every spot on the field, and you try and defend, some people say 15, some people say 19 different spots on the field, and you try and defend a portion of them. Maybe you try and defend 14 on a play or 13 on a play, and then if the ball's thrown perfectly, there's just no defense for it.
Okay. Well, then let's use that transition to get into Ladarius Webb, who I thought was frustrating me during the game yesterday until his interception.
Yeah, I would think that would do it for you. So athletic interception in the end zone, real diving interception. He was behind the receiver on that play, but the ball was thrown behind the receiver also. And then Webb dove in, made a very athletic interception, I thought. Had to be encouraged not to get up and return the ball by Eric Weddle, but that was good too. And the very first play of the game, I was impressed with the play Webb made. The Browns ran it's a misdirection play. I don't know that I'd really call it a trick play, but they had two linemen pull towards the right side. So it says run right all over it. And then they handed the ball to Crowell, who ran a sweep to the left. And Suggs kind of chased it down, but he wasn't fast enough to get him. And it was Webb who came in and undercut Crowell for a 3-yard gain on what looked like it could have been a 20 or 25-yard play. So impressive play there for Lardarius. Still plays the run aggressively and well, even at his age.
All right. So maybe as much as I thought it was frustrating, that was just me in the TV coverage. Mm-hmm. And he did all right. The guy who just made the most unbelievable play yesterday in the game is the next guy on the list, Eric Weddle.
Yeah. Remarkable collected tip for his first INT of the year. He had some nice bracket coverage on the back end too, but otherwise a pretty quiet game. But that's the kind of interception that this secondary is really feeling it to be collecting balls like that. That's a very difficult interception to make, and they dropped some easy ones, frankly, yesterday. Marlon Humphrey, we haven't talked about yet, dropped what would have been a fairly easy first interception for him. And Derek Carr, Brandon Carr, had an uncontested interception along the right sideline that he also dropped. So it's not like they converted every opportunity, but they're getting a lot of opportunities, and they're converting most of them.
That's good news. We got two guys left, I guess, Anthony Levine and Tony Jefferson.
Okay, well, Anthony Levine, I think what I want to talk about with him is the success of the dime in general, because Anthony Levine is typically in coverage. He sometimes rushes the passer, but he's doing something to take away a target that we can't necessarily see. And the success of the dime this year has been just astoundingly astounding. They've run 34, I want to get my numbers right, so I'm going to go over my spreadsheet right here. They've had 34 dime snaps on the season so far in two games. Now, first of all, that's way more than Pease has run in the past. He only had run 148 total dime snaps prior to this year in five seasons. So 34 in two games. They've allowed 4.6 yards per play on those. They've had three sacks on 34 plays, which is excellent. But more impressive, they've had six turnovers on 34 dime snaps. So they put that six defensive back on the field, and that secondary is looking to hunt for the football. So it's been great. A couple of those have been strip sacks as well. So very impressive set of plays by that group.
That's good. That's great. And we didn't mention Humphrey, did we?
No, we should probably talk about him, because he's a rookie and he's played great ball. He's now played 19 snaps. The Ravens have only given up 27 total yards on his 19 snaps, 1.4 yards per play, by far leads the team. He had a near interception. He had a nice tackle immediately on Ricardo Lewis for a 3-yard inbounds gain, which in Q4 with a minute and change left to go was important that the Browns be kept in bounds, more so than he prevent a reception at that point. But in any case, that's a great play on both counts. He looks like the real deal. And I'd love to say I saw the ball skills yesterday, but he did drop his interception opportunity. But he should get a lot more playing time. And they will have to try and figure a way either to rotate him in a little bit, perhaps for replacing a guy who's just covered a 9 route. We talked about that after the first game as being a possibility. But he's played well enough that he has to force his way into this lineup somehow.
All right, so a little bit more of the tennis ball drill for Marlon Humphrey. And just more playing time, more experience, and he's a guy to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's kind of close out this game with our defensive stars of the game.
Okay, sure thing. So, I will. How would you like to do this? You want to go first? You want to go second in this? Or what would you like to do?
We can go back and forth.
Okay, go ahead.
I started out with Matthew Judon. He seemed to be all over the place, and he was watching on TV, saw him all the time up there, so I went with him.
Okay, very good. Recovered that fumble. That was sweet. And certainly playing a lot of snaps on the defensive line. I can't argue with that one. I had number three. I had Terrell Suggs again. I had the five pressures he got. The fact that he did a good job against Thomas, I thought, was a lot of value. And it's, again, a game where there could have been a lot of stars, a lot of players' named, but Suggs getting that strip really started the defensive effort going.
At what point are we going to retire Terrell Suggs from your defensive star list?
Oh, boy. And I'm not doing it.
No, he's going to be there each week.
He's important.
All right. I went with Weddle, number two, because that interception was one of the best defensive catches I've seen.
Yeah, very impressive. And I think you could be other reasons to get Weddle on there, too, but that was a hell of an interception, that's for sure. Number two for me, Tyus Bowser. All-around effort, 34 snaps in this game. I think he deserves more, and looks like the Sam linebacker they could have hoped at the best he would be when they drafted him this year.
All right. My number one, I went with Hugh Jackson. Because the game, the Ravens were doing really well with Deshaun Kizer and really shutting him down. And then they pulled him for a migraine, apparently.
Yeah.
And then I got a little concerned because Kevin Hogan came in and was throwing the ball around, got his first career touchdown, and I was a little concerned. But then they pulled him and put Kizer back in. So I'm going to give it to Hugh Jackson for putting Kizer back in.
All right. All right. Well, I like the way you always pick an opposing player. I don't think it would honestly matter who the quarterback was back there. They were going to be living in fear. But you're right. Maybe Hogan would have been more effective than Kizer in this particular game. So Brandon Carr is my number one. Outstanding game. Shut down their big receivers. Used the boundary exceptionally well. Made one pick, and that's two picks now, which is more than he's had in the last 3 years combined. He had one interception. He's had two in the last two games. So exciting in what he's brought, and he's far exceeded my expectations of where he would be. I thought there was a good chance Marlon Humphrey would be pushing him for playing time right now, and now it's a real question of how do we get Humphrey in the game, and Brandon Carr has really played very well and deserves to play.
That's, I mean, again, we're saying we've got too many stars on the defensive side.
Yeah.
That's a great thing to hear, and I hope it continues. This week, the Ravens are heading to London. So this is like the cruise ship going over, so they're practicing and adjusting as the boat moves, right?
I assume they're flying.
No, in April, the Ravens announced they're all taking a cruise ship. It was their
Did
big,
they?
Yeah, it was their big April 1st announcement.
Oh, okay. That's very funny. Yeah, I saw some reference to that in the paper. I guess I missed the connection.
That was the Ravens'
there,
April Fool's Day joke, where they said they were going to take the boat so that their bodies could adjust to the travel schedule, and then that way they could practice on the boat, and they were having a football field built on the boat. The logic kind of made you look at it and say, well, actually, maybe they should take a boat. But no, they're flying like a normal trip.
Right. Football players don't like to spend a lot of time away from home. Joe Flacco is coming at. We're not baseball players.
Also,
you know.
Yes. Also, a lot of those guys are really big, and I've been on a cruise ship. Those rooms are really small.
Yes.
So I don't think that would work. Do you know what their travel schedule is for London?
I think they said they were leaving on Thursday, and they would normally, I guess, go on Saturday to go to a new city, but I think it's Thursday, arrive Friday, if I recall. And they said that spending Thursday night on the plane, and the only thing different is they're going to sleep on the plane, and they're still going to practice on Friday, which probably means like a literally a walkthrough of what the game plan is on Friday in London.
Yeah, I never understand why they say, all right, why the game is at 9:30 in the morning, because you would think you want to keep it on like at least East Coast time or something that the football teams are more used to, and try to keep it at 1:30 Eastern, 1 o'clock Eastern.
Yeah, and then it would be 6 or 7 o'clock there, which wouldn't be a terrible time to have a football game on a Saturday night, so or on a Sunday rather. So you would figure it'd be fine.
Right. So I don't know. 9:30 is weird to me. It's mm-hmm. I mean, I can't, of course it's weird. It happens twice a year, and that's it. But I never understood how that didn't hurt your teams.
Yeah, I mean, there will be a real question because the Ravens will come back from this and they'll play the Steelers and then they'll have to play Oakland and just hope that London doesn't mess them up.
I mean, yeah, the NFL has shown us that they don't care by adding Thursday night games and Sunday night, Saturday night games. And they've shown us they don't really care about that, but whatever it does. But still, 9:30 in the morning, I guess that the marketing idea is then you have four games.
Extra time slot. I don't know that it really has a lot of value. I've never known anyone who wasn't their team to really get up for the Jacksonville or the Tampa 9 a.m. game because that's, you know, who cares.
Now, you're going out to London, right?
Yeah, we are.
All right. I got a question for you. And you, I've been to London once. I only went to London for 24 hours. And just a quick layover, and I went and explored the city. So my question is not about London. My question is about the football fans. And I take note on if people from England go to the football game or if having the football – is the football game in London growing excitement in London for football? Which I hear it's not. Or is the football game in London more Americans flying over to cheer on their team in a new stadium?
Okay. I mean, I think there's some of each, but they wouldn't be doing it if there wasn't some opportunity to grow a fan base in the UK and perhaps in Europe in general as time rolls forward.
And I think there's opportunity. I just don't think it's working.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's I don't know. My theory is the commissioner just wants this and insists that this is going to happen when I don't know if London wants this.
Okay, well, I mean, there's a lot of population over there and a lot of dollars to spend, and it makes sense that you would go after this. And I will say this, the PFF people are UK-based, and there's knowledgeable football fans over there, even though you wouldn't assume that would be the case.
And yeah, I guess it's a merchandising move, too. I guess, if anything, the Chargers are showing us now in L.A. that you don't have to attend the games to be popular. The L.A. doesn't seem to care that they have the Chargers as far as attendance, but I'm sure they're making up for it in L.A. merchandise.
Yeah.
So, all right, Ken, so where can guys find you and interact with you this week on Twitter?
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, love to hear from you on Twitter. We didn't do a mailbag segment this week, but we want to keep doing this in the future. And if you leave your questions with hashtag Film Study Mailbag, that'd be great. I'll find them there. I'm at Film Study Ravens online, and if you on Twitter, and if you go to look my articles on Russell Street Reports, which are a lot more detailed than what we're able to get into here, look for Film Study there. And Josh, we need to also talk about our sister program, which is the 336 Show.
Yeah. Yeah, before I mention Section 336, make sure you send all of your Twitter questions about Marshall Yanda to at Film Study Ravens so that we can talk about Marshall Yanda on Wednesday. And maybe would that be our goodbye episode to Marshall Yanda?
I hope
That's
not.
A question. My show is Section 336. It is a Monday night show on Baltimore sports. I do it with me and my brother and brother-in-law, and we yell at each other about the Orioles or the Ravens or whatever else is going on. This week, we are joined by Adam Pohl, who is the play-by-play guy for the Bowie Bay Sox. So he will be joining us in studio, and we'll talk about the Bay Sox season. They went to the playoffs again in a very successful year, and they've got some stars that are going to quickly make their way up to the majors. Some of them are now with the Orioles now with the September call-ups, and some guys like Cedric Mullins are going to be competing this spring to try to make the big league.
Is the Bay Sox out now, or are they still alive in the playoffs?
No, they are out. The Orioles stripped their best players for September ball. So there's a little that's definitely going to be a question I've got for Adam, is how's that make you feel? Because I know some Bay Sox fans were not so happy about that.
Right.
And it's a question of does my winning in the minors help you? Some people think it does because it teaches you how to win championships. Others, it's all about the majors and whatever it takes for the majors. So we're going to talk to Adam about that, about some players and whatever else. So it should be a good show.
That does sound like a really good show. And it sounds like one of the things Buck does is always know who his emergency pitcher is going to be. And I'd like to understand how that process works, if you can put one in your mailbag for that. Is, you know, how does the communication process go between Buck and the
minors?
And the people at Double A? Yeah.
All right. I will pass that on. So. All right, Ken. Well, we will talk in a day or two and talk about Marshall Yanda.
Well, that's good. Take it easy, Josh.
Bye.